All right. We have a lot to cover here tonight. It always seems so tricky to cover all of these things in a 30-minute Dharma talk. Each one of these topics deserves a talk of its own, but here we are, and so we're gonna do it. And tonight I wanted to discuss the third, fourth, and fifth path factors of the Eightfold Path, which are wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood. And just to give a short review of how we got here, a couple of weeks ago, Meg gave a Dharma talk about the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering in life. There is a cause to that suffering. There's a way to end suffering. And the way to do that is by following the Eightfold Path. And the Buddha goes on to explain in the Second Noble Truth that the cause of suffering is craving. Craving for things to be different than the way that they are. And this craving can come in two different flavors, either clinging or pushing away. We tend to cling to the pleasant and push away the unpleasant. And this brings us suffering because of what we know about impermanence. So if everything in this world is impermanent, including physical items, sensations, and emotions, what happens when we try to hold on to the pleasant? As soon as it starts to fade away, we're going to get rope burn from hanging on to that. And if we don't ever allow the unpleasant to arise, how will it ever pass? A popular way of avoiding the unpleasant is when people abuse drugs and alcohol. We don't want to deal with our depression, so we get high. But guess what? As soon as you sober up, that depression is still there waiting for you. You know, it didn't go anywhere. So in order to let something pass, you have to let it arise. And this is what we practice during meditation. This is the rising and passing of all phenomena, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So it's kind of training for us for the things that we encounter off of the cushion and in the real world. Then the Buddha goes on to explain the third noble truth. And this is where there's actually some good news. There's a way to reduce and even eliminate the suffering in our lives. How we do that is by following the Eightfold Path, which is the fourth noble truth. And last week, Carol introduced us to the Eightfold Path by giving a talk on wise view, or sometimes called wise understanding, and wise intention, sometimes called wise thought. These two path factors are considered to be the wisdom factors of the path. And as Carol explained, that these factors are presented in a certain order, which is done for a reason, but they don't necessarily need to be followed in any linear order. So don't think that you need to master path factors 1 and 2 before moving on to 3, 4, and 5. And once we have an understanding of the full Eightfold Path, we begin to explore it with what we need to practice on an individual basis. So some weeks I may need to work on wise speech. Other weeks I need to work on wise effort. And that's why we can kind of jump around the path factors. We want to try to practice them all of the time. But in reality, it's kind of like mixing a track when recording music. Sometimes this track needs to be turned up a little bit. Sometimes this track needs to be turned down a little bit. And hopefully we can find that perfect mix. And so tonight I wanted to talk about the next set of path factors, which are considered to be the morality factors. And again, those are wise speech, wise actions, and wise livelihood. I think the Buddha didn't start off the Eightfold Path with these factors because he understood that for us to take these factors on as a practice, we need to first understand why we're practicing. The first two path factors point us in the right direction, and as we continue down the path, these factors will help steer us so we don't veer off of the path. I mean, I can tell you all about wise speech, but if you don't understand why we're practicing wise speech, it may be more difficult for you to actually practice it and stick to it. So let's start by looking at the third path factor, which is wise speech. And this is actually one of my favorite topics because it is such a big part of my practice. I also feel like it's really a relevant topic for right now because of everything that's happening in the world and all the different ways that we can add our input. I mean, we've got COVID-19 and masks, we've got Black Lives Matter and police reform, we've got an upcoming presidential election. You know, not only do we have the good old-fashioned face-to-face conversations, but there's about a dozen social media sites that are popular right now. There's ways of commenting on news articles on the internet, YouTube videos. So many hot button issues and so many ways to communicate about them. And I feel like now is more important than ever to focus on what we're saying, how we're saying it, and who we're saying it to. Here's how the Buddha described wise speech. And this comes directly from one of the Buddhist suttas, which is why I'm going to use the word right instead of wise. And Carol talked about this last week, I believe, where the word right can sometimes have a dogmatic feel to it. You know, it's like right versus wrong. And that's definitely not how the Buddha intended that word to be perceived. The word right is more like virtuous or noble. But anyway, he says, and what is right speech? Abstaining from lying, from divisive speech, from abusive speech, and from idle chatter. This is called right speech. And so to make it even straightforward than that, you can ask yourself, is it true? Is it gossip? Is it kind? And is it necessary or timely? So let's look at the first one here. Is it true? And at first glance, it seems pretty cut and dry, right? Is it the truth or is it a lie? But there's so much more to it. I mean, if you intentionally tell a lie in a malicious way to either hurt someone or further your own gain at the expense of another, that's obviously unskillful and not considered to be wise speech. But what about when we don't tell the truth because we don't want to hurt someone? Have you ever been invited to something you don't want to go to? And you have to make up a story instead of saying, sorry, I don't want to go because that doesn't interest me. Of course we have. I mean, we all have. You know, in an effort to be kind, we normally say, thanks for the invite, but I already have plans that night, or I'd like to go, but I'm just not feeling well. What about if you're at someone's house for dinner and you don't like the main course? You're going to tell them you don't like your dinner, or you're going to tell them something different because you don't want to hurt their feelings? You know, there are certain things that we say that are technically lies, but we do so in order not to hurt the other person. Is that okay? Honestly, I don't know. I'm not going to pretend like I have all the answers here. In fact, I can promise you that I don't. But what we want to do is start thinking about what we're saying and how we're saying it. Because maybe there are other ways of telling the truth, but doing it in a kind way. And then there's also these things that we call big fish stories, right? So we tend to exaggerate the truth in an effort to either make the story sound more interesting or maybe to impress someone. You know, it's the old, I caught a fish this big. Well, yeah, maybe you caught a fish, but it was really only that big. And I think this happens more often than we're aware of. It was Mark Twain that said, or at least he was attributed with saying, if you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything. It's a lot of work to keep track of all the lies and exaggerations. And it often leads to telling more lies to support the original lie. And who wants that burden? That's a lot to carry around. The second piece we want to look at is it gossip? Talking about someone to someone else while that person isn't present. And this is especially problematic when you're talking maliciously about that person or repeating something that you heard from somebody else. Because what if what you're saying isn't true? That person isn't even there to defend themselves, tell their side of the story. You can cause some serious, serious harm to that person by talking behind their back. And I worry about this quite a bit in our world of social media today. How quickly does something spread on the internet these days? You know, once it's out there, truth or not. There's no taking it back. So it's important to come back to our fundamental question, will this cause harm? If the answer is yes, or maybe, or even I don't know, maybe we don't want to proceed. Now looking at the third piece of wise speech, is it kind? And another way that the Buddha worded this was, is it harsh or abusive? And this one is pretty straightforward, but it can be difficult to develop. I think the main focus of this aspect is the emotional tone of our minds and hearts when communicating with others. The Buddha said, one should speak such words as are gentle, soothing to the ear, loving. Such words as go to the heart are courteous, friendly, and agreeable to many. So looking at the energy behind our words, are we speaking out of anger or frustration? What are our intentions? And then for the final aspect of wise speech, we want to look at is it timely? And this is sometimes referred to as idle chatter or useless, frivolous talk. And this is what we do to avoid any gaps in the conversation, often called awkward silences. And for some reason, our society has deemed silence to be awkward. So we're constantly trying to fill the gaps. But if we constantly fill the space with idle chatter, our words begin to lose meaning. I mean, what we have to say holds less value because it seems to be never ending. I think we've all known that person who doesn't have a lot to say, but when they do talk, it always seems like so profound and deliberate. Another aspect of timely communication goes back to your intention or your energy. You know, just because something is true, just because it's not gossip, and even if you're saying it kindly, it still may not be the right time to bring it up. Some conversations should be private, so you shouldn't bring it up during a party. Some conversations aren't appropriate during times of grief or trauma, and even happy times. If what you're about to say is going to take away somebody's happiness, is it really the appropriate time to say it? And this isn't a practice where we're expected to be perfect. So, you know, there are so many gray areas here. I'm not going to tell my nephew that Santa Claus isn't real. I don't want to ruin his belief in Santa Claus just because I'm worried about the karma of telling a lie. You know, sometimes it's okay. Sometimes we can't cause no harm, so we have to choose the path of causing less harm. And so I invite you to take on one or two of these, or maybe even all of them for a certain period of time and see what it feels like. And I encourage you to practice with each other. Sometimes it can be a bit odd practicing wise speech with a coworker or someone who has no idea what you're doing. You know, all of a sudden you're just super quiet and contemplating everything. You know, can make things a little bit weird from time to time. But I used to encourage Sangha members to get together for a cup of tea or coffee and just sit and only speak when your words pass the four hurdles of wise speech. And it's actually quite interesting to see how often the mind wants to gossip or fill that empty space. Try it out for yourself. Now, the next path factor I want to talk about is wise action. And this is the fourth of the Eightfold Path. And similar to wise speech, wise action is especially relevant right now. There's a lot happening in our society and around the world. There's this cultural shift, and it's not uncommon to be questioning our old norms and values, and it could be very confusing about what to say and do and what not to say and do. And in times like this, it's especially important to not get caught up in our impulses and reactions. We need to remember the importance of personal integrity and responsibility. The Buddha once said, avoid what is unskillful, do what is good. Purify the mind. All of the path factors I'm speaking about tonight revolve around abstaining from unskillful acts and doing what is good. And if we can do this, we can find peace. So again, quoting from one of the Buddhist suttas, here's what the Buddha said about wise and what he calls right action. And what, monks, is right action? Refraining from taking life, refraining from taking what is not given, refraining from sexual misconduct, this is called right action. So pretty simple, right? Don't kill, don't steal, don't harm with our sexuality. And later on in this course, I think a few weeks from now, We'll be talking about the five precepts, and we'll be able to dive into each one of these topics a little bit deeper. But for tonight, let's examine each one of these in a quicker fashion. So don't kill also includes abstaining from physical harm of others or ourselves. And this means we're not supposed to kill other people, no killing animals for sport or pleasure, and not killing living beings because we don't like what they look like. And so many years ago, before I took on the precept of non-harming, I used to kill the spiders I'd find in my house. I'd kill them because every now and then I would wake up with a spider bite, and I didn't like that. So if I found one in my room before going to bed, I'd kill it. But after taking this precept of non-harming, I started relocating the spiders from my room to outside. And the spiders I couldn't get in the jar, you know, those pesky little ones that go into the corner or they're on the ceiling and you just can't get to them, I just let them be. And I kid you not, I have not had a single spider bite since I stopped killing them. I don't know what it is. We have this like peaceful agreement with each other where, you know, I don't kill them and they don't bite me. So we're living peacefully together. We're both better off because of it. And even when practicing non-harming, it would be impossible for me to not kill another animal 100% of the time. When I'm walking, I'm stepping on ants. When I drive, I hit bugs. Even as a vegetarian, the gardens that grow my food kill worms and bugs when tilling the dirt. So this practice isn't about being perfect. It's about our intentions. And I will always choose the path of non-harming when possible. And when not possible, I will always try to cause as little harm as possible. Not stealing is another precept I've committed to. And this is often taught as abstaining from taking what is not given. This is an important one in our society because of all of our interpersonal relationships. By abstaining from taking what is not given, we're creating a refuge of safety and trust. Remember that craving or clinging is the cause of suffering, and stealing is feeding these feelings of greed. It's like, I need to have this. Even though it's not mine, I'm going to take it. We're acting on our desires rather than being able to sit with the uncomfortable. Want it, but I can't have it. A lot of people steal because of a fear of not having enough. So it's not always malicious intent, but you know, it still causes harm. And when you do steal, not only are you creating mistrust with others, but you have to carry around this heavy burden of guilt. Again, how can you have this calm, peaceful mind when you're bearing this heavy load? And in addition to blatant robbery or theft, you know, taking what is not given can be so much more subtle. You know, for instance, taking more than what is offered might be an unwise action. So in passing around the basket of dinner rolls, instead of taking one so there's enough for everyone, if you take two or three, you know, or if someone brings donuts into the office and you go back for seconds before everyone's had an opportunity to get there first. You know, it's being greedy. And some of these things may not sound like a big deal, but you know, this is how we fine tune our practice. It's really easy not to kill someone or not to rob a bank. You know, and that might be enough for some people. But if you want to deepen your practice and your exploration of these actions, try not killing the spider. You know, try not taking more than your fair share, even when you're tempted to. And being wise with our sexuality. So this is another fun one to talk about because there's so many what ifs and what about this topics that arise. Abstaining from sexual misconduct has different meanings depending on the context of our lives. So for monks and nuns, or meditators that are on retreat, this means refraining from any sexual activity. This includes others and ourselves. So again, you know, when this can be practiced, it cultivates this level of safety for others. Thich Nhat Hanh says, "Aware of the suffering caused by sexual misconduct, I vow to cultivate responsibility and learn ways to protect the safety and integrity of others, couples, families, and society. To preserve the happiness of myself and others, I'm determined to respect my commitments and the commitments of others. I will do everything in my power protect children from sexual abuse and to prevent couples and families from being broken by sexual misconduct. I just think that's a beautiful commitment because, I mean, we all know how powerful of a force sexual energy is. How many crimes are committed because of our unwholesome actions around sexuality? And even things that aren't considered to be crimes are so harmful to others, making people feel unsafe to walk home at night, making people feel bad about themselves because they don't look like the person on the magazine cover. You know, there's invasion of privacy, tempting others to break commitments, the list goes on and on and on. Sexuality is a form of craving, and craving causes suffering. But this is where it gets complicated because sexuality is also a beautiful, beautiful thing. It brings people together, creates families. So for someone who is not on retreat or hasn't become a monk or a nun, it's unrealistic to ask for a life of celibacy. But I think from time to time, it can be a healthy way to investigate our relationship to it, to see what our craving around sexuality is like. You probably just want to make sure you talk to your significant other about it first and, you know, explain why you're doing it. And what we're trying to do here is create some space between our urges and our actions so that we can respond rather than react. I think Viktor Frankl really says it best. And again, I'm paraphrasing here, but he says, between a stimulus and a response, there is a space. And in that space lies freedom. This is how we can begin to respond in a way that will cultivate wholesomeness and not create any harm, by creating that space to respond rather than to react. Wise livelihood is the next path factor, and this is the fifth of the Eightfold Path. Livelihood is basically what we do for work. I'm discussing wise livelihood can be kind of interesting conversation because our society is so different than when the Buddha taught this path factor some 2,600 years ago. But his underlying teaching is still relevant for helping us to suffer less. You know, so often we separate our work from our spiritual practice. They feel like two different things, right? But the Buddha teaches us that this part of our lives is a huge part of our path to awakening. And think about it, it's not unusual for our work to occupy more time than anything else in our lives. I can't think of anything else that I do that takes up more time than work. Sadly, not even sleep. And so what we do for work undoubtedly feeds into our moral compass and our karma. With wise view, we have an understanding of what is and what isn't wholesome. We also have an understanding that when we cultivate more wholesomeness or refrain from unwholesomeness, we will have less suffering in our lives. So in this regard, the Buddha mentions five kinds of livelihood that we want to avoid. Trading in weapons and instruments for killing, trading in human beings, both adults and children. And this may seem foreign to some of us, but sadly, it still happens all over the world, including the United States. We want to avoid livelihoods involving meat production and the killing of animals, manufacturing or selling intoxicants or addictive drugs, and producing or trading any kind of poison. The Buddha also talked about abstaining from any livelihood involving deceit. So if you have to lie for your job, it may not be that wise. The reason the Buddha specifically listed these livelihoods to avoid is because they all cause harm in one way or another. There's also a way to understand wise livelihood for its positive aspects. So are we being of service in our livelihood? Do we work with care? Are we being patient, kind, helpful? Right? Livelihood is not only about what we do, but how we do it. And this can be easily understood by thinking about our own experiences with others, right? So for instance, you go to a restaurant and you order your food. If the server is friendly and helpful, you know, that experience is going to leave you feeling good, right? But if the server is rude and careless, experience is going to leave you feeling not so good. So how we do our jobs directly affects the well-being of those we're serving. If we do our best to not cause harm, we're actually cultivating generosity and loving kindness. Another topic around livelihood that can be helpful to explore is our relationship to money. And this can be complicated because money is often viewed as something evil. We think we need to avoid it in order to live a wholesome, and spiritual life. But in the Buddha's teachings, if we obtain our wealth in a wholesome way, it can be seen as a blessing and something that could be used to benefit the welfare of others. I mentioned earlier that, you know, livelihood looks very different today than it did 2,600 years ago. If you're dealing drugs or murdering people for a living, it's probably not the best occupation for living a wholesome life. But, you know, what about working in restaurants or grocery stores? It's a very, very popular occupation. So if you're serving someone a glass of wine with their filet mignon, are you being of service to them? Or are you contributing to the sale of intoxicants and harming of animals? And I'm only mentioning this, you know, to point out that there are huge gray areas here. So the point of wise livelihood isn't to shame you for what you're doing for a living, but rather to have you investigate your livelihood, pay attention to what you're doing, how it makes you feel, and pay attention to how you're doing it, because that directly affects how it makes other people feel. One of the greatest things the Buddha said was, don't take my word for it. See for yourself. Nothing here is a rule or a law or a commandment. All of the Buddhist teachings are meant to be explored on a personal level. And it's not an all or nothing philosophy either. So see for yourself what is beneficial. Take what works and leave behind what doesn't. These topics are extremely important to investigate on our own. There's also so much more to be explored. Summarizing them in 30-minute Dharma talk is like it's barely scratching the surface. So I encourage you to read more about them, listen to other Dharma talks about them, and without any judgment, to see how they come up in your everyday life. You know, the first step of creating space, you know, the space where the freedom lies is to notice the stimulus. So if all you do for the next week is just simply notice what is happening, bringing awareness to your speech, your actions, and your livelihood, you will have done amazing work.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.